I think what they're actually going to do is continue to label his tweets in this particular way, but we're going to see continued backlashes accordingly as well.
Ramesh Srinivasan, we have to have you back on, but I want to thank you for being with us, professor in the Department of Information Studies, design director at UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. If you want to sign up for our daily quarantine report, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriana Contreras, Maria Tarasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on a Friday, which means, well, girls are always powerful, but it is time for you to make sure that you mind the gap. This is Girls Are Powerful on KBOO Portland, your community radio.
Thank you, Beyonce. That is true. We do run the world. I am Tammy, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. On the line with me is the lovely and amazing Althea Billings. And if you hear me kind of winded, it's because I was totally dancing to that.
Hi.
How are you doing, Althea?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm well. I think it's about day 60-something on quarantine. So just you know, I think it's... And I think it's Friday, so that's good. How about you?
Yeah. I've decided that today is casual Friday.
Oh, okay.
I think we deserve it, you know. We deserve to let loose a little bit.
Do you usually wake up and put on, like a power suit or something?
Here's the thing. Being on the radio and working from home, that's my mystique. You never know what I'm actually up to. So maybe I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt today.
Ooh.
Because it's casual Friday.
Well, you know, just the top has to be presentable. You could be wearing PJ bottoms. That's what I'm learning.
Yeah.
But don't get up in the middle.
That's turned into professional attire, weirdly enough. my wearing real pants or like a nice shirt, that's for some occasion that has not come along yet. So
that's
kind of exciting.
The before times.
It's from the before times. It's kind of exciting. Like, what could it be, you know? When will it be that I put on like an outfit? But yeah, I'm wearing the Hawaiian shirt today.
That's nice.
Friday.
Yeah. It's been a casual weekday or just casual month for Tammy, so definitely have not quite tried to put on an appearance. Every once in a while I want to go to the grocery store, but then I try to get all dolled up, and then I'm like, I'm gonna just make sure that I have a mask and lather myself in like hand sanitizer and stuff. I lose all focus of trying to be cute and go towards safe.
Yeah. Well, look, we're practiced at that now, you know, like you said, 60 days we've been out here.
Been here, actually.
That's true. Language is failing me. Anyway.
It's hard. It's difficult. I get it. But we do appreciate everyone tuning in, and I appreciate Sonia and Aram. Thank you so much for all of your hard work this week and also today. And on today's show, well, Althea, I think it was last week we were talking about censorship and the media, and you and I were talking off there. And just like all of the stuff that the president is doing that seems to be kind of unprecedented and almost kind of like shocking and jarring, but you were telling me that no, this is something that's been happening, not just now, not just in the 70s, but all the way back to good old John Adams.
We were talking about everything that's been going on with Trump's tweets, and that this week Twitter has fact-checked it, put a little footnote on his tweet saying that mail-in ballots were going to be fraudulent, unreliable, corrupt, and it was a little like blue link that said get the facts about mail-in voting, and it linked to something basically refuting everything that he had said. And though Twitter didn't censor this other thing, this week he was also saying that this woman who used to work for Joe Scarborough, who's a host on MSNBC and who, like, you know, doesn't really like Trump and says that on television, that one of his aides in many years ago, like, died of heart failure complications, and like Trump was tweeting that like Joe Scarborough was involved. Twitter didn't do anything about that one, but there was a little. He did get fact-checked, and so yesterday he came out with this executive order that asks the SEC and the FTC to sort of reevaluate the language in this 1996 law that allows the internet to exist, basically, and that doesn't. Basically, it's called Section 230, and it means that online platforms, tech companies, they have a lot of leeway when it comes to what goes on their site and how they choose to moderate it. Like, the assumption from the law's perspective is that they're acting in good faith. And so he, in decrying censorship about this this fact check, he has asked that the FCC and the FCC reevaluate that and maybe open the door for federal regulators to come at tech companies like Google or Twitter or Facebook, come at them harder with the decisions that they make about how they like moderate content, if they like suspend an account or like delete bots or whatever. That could be under a lot more scrutiny, and it feels like a wild thing to do because, you know, most of the time it seems like politically we're in agreement, hey, you can't censor people, and censoring like a political or a social media platform, forcing them to abide by different rules, that seems like kind of choking out free speech, and I thought we weren't doing that. I thought we all kind of agreed. But actually,
I'll go for it.
And then what Tammy and I were speaking about, to circle back to that, is that John Adams fully also couldn't handle criticism, and second president of the U.S., he signed this act, the Alien and Sedition Act, that made it illegal to write, print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious writing or writings against the president or anyone who worked in the executive branch with him, and fully, like, enforced it. So his political enemies ended up in jail. There was a parade or something happening in a city, and someone in a bar was like, ugh, Adams, that guy, blah. And somebody like tattled on him, and he got in trouble. Eventually, obviously, the law got destroyed because his opponents eventually got into office and were like, "Hey, that's not free speech or free press. You can't." And there is, you know, libel exists. If you actually print lies about somebody, they can sue you for that because you've defamed them. But it's not a new thing. It's not a new thing about a leader getting getting upset about someone out there saying something mean about them and then trying to use the power of the president to change that. Can't deal with the scorn of someone throwing facts at you, I suppose.
It's really, well, you know, going to circling back to more recently with Trump trying to, I don't want to say censor the internet, but that's, I guess, you know, in lamest terms, isn't that kind of silly considering that he basically, like, relied on fake news and, like, Cambridge Analytica to sway votes? Was that kind of shooting yourself in your own foot? But I don't know.
No, I mean, it's a point well taken. And, I mean, it's not, you know, his intentions, he's not trying to hide his intentions about when do we care about what the internet did, when mm-hmm. do we care about if someone said something that's untrue, when it's Cambridge Analytica, you know, stealing user data and manipulating people into getting him into office, it's fine. But Twitter fact-checking him is not fine. I should footnote that and say that legal, people who know stuff about the law, people who know stuff about, like, technology law specifically, they feel very strongly that this this executive order isn't going to stand. It goes against 20 years of, like, interpreting that law and how it applies to companies, so you'd be kind of hard-pressed to find a judge who will throw out everything everyone before him has thought. And also, it asks the FCC and the FTC to enforce it, and they're actually independent regulatory agencies, so they're not on the president's cabinet. So for them, it's an advisory. They don't actually have to do it. So we'll see.
And to note that right now, you know, you mentioned Twitter and, you know, Trump's tweets, and right now it seems like most of his tweets are either attacking someone or discrediting someone or even organizations, individuals, victims, anything. And so, but he's doing it on a platform that's not only open to the American people, but to the whole wide world. And this is something that, so Nixon, this is, Nixon had an opponent's list or an enemies list, and this was like in the 70s. And
yeah.
That list wasn't made public until like 73 when John Dean informed the Senate Watergate Committee about the list. And that list included regular, like, journalists, political enemies, and, you know, just people who in any way, shape, or form were critics of the president. Now, when you said manipulating, you know, your power in the highest office, it doesn't necessarily just say, oh, I don't like this Twitter account or I'm going to shut it down or something. It's in this article that I was reading, I don't know if this is something that's factual or not, but it included that the IRS were used as a tool to harass these people that were on the enemy list in order to find, you know, like, dirt on them or to basically discredit them to the public. And I do have a video of Daniel Shore, who was a CBS news reporter during that time, and he was actually on that list. And this clip that we're going to play is him describing what it was like seeing his own name on the president's enemy list during a live broad news broadcast. Sonny, do you have that clip?
And all this was fine during the early years. I think something happened to him as he began to approach 1972 and re-election. Another side of him appeared that I didn't see very clearly then, although in retrospect, having spent a lot of time studying it, I now realize what it was. He had a paranoid side to him, and the paranoid side saw enemies. Where Americans would generally talk about rivals, adversaries, and so on, he had this word, enemies, which meant something far beyond somebody who's just running against you for office. And so he began doing these quite weird things, like putting a group of people in the White House called the White House Plumbers, who were his own little police force, wiretaps, enemies lists, an FBI investigation of me. And in that respect, I'll tell you the two signal moments there. Enemies lists. The enemies list were basically written around 1971 as it began to approach the 72 election. Their existence was not known out of the White House. We only got to know about it in 1973 when John Dean, who had jumped ship from the Nixon White House, testified before the Senate Watergate Committee about the existence of enemies lists. He submitted them in evidence but didn't read them on television. We, with the other networks, were gavel to gavel covering these hearings. I was outside, along with Douglas Kiker of NBC and Sam Donaldson of ABC, each talking into his own camera, talking about these enemies lists, but we didn't have any names. And I could hear in my ear from my producer back at CBS, get names, who, what? And eventually, as we were talking, somebody came up and handed each of us a list. I was on the air live. I didn't have time to look at this document before I started reading it live. And so I said, all right, here is the first of there are numbered 20 names, numbered. And let's see, it is from John Dean to H.R. Haldeman, subject on screwing our political enemies. And I began to read down the list until I came to number 17. And 17, Daniel Schorr, notation, a real media enemy. And then I don't know how I looked at it. I've never seen the tape, but I felt as though I was going to gulp and collapse. But I did manage to say number 18, Paul Newman, number 19, Mary McGrory, number 20, and now back to you. And broke into a big sweat. The idea of becoming that I was a part of the story that I was covering was really quite incredible.
You could just imagine hearing your name on a list written by the president, reading it live, not knowing you're on there. Boy, I would have fainted too. I totally understand. And also John Dean, who was the person that informed the Senate committee about the Senate Watergate committee about the list, was later on being blamed alongside John Mitchell for being the mastermind behind the Watergate scandal by the White House. So that's, you know, it took a lot of twists and turns. And then also the list itself made it into Article 2 of the impeachment charges. And Americans were, you know, the way that this article describes it, Americans were outraged. They were disgusted and outraged that the president and the highest office in the land would abuse their power and punish, and I'm quoting, citizens who were legitimately doing their business. And fast forward to now, you know, Trump is using pretty much similar, if not like identical, methods to discredit his critics, whether it's on Twitter, on air, you know, on the television. But it doesn't seem like that outrage is there. It doesn't seem like we are, you know, feeling as though or publicly saying that this is an inappropriate type of behavior to come from the highest office of the land. So that was Daniel Schorr speaking about reading his name on the enemies list created by the Nixon administration in the early 70s.
Yeah, and, you know, President Trump has similar people. It's one of those, you know, it really is overwhelming to remember everything that one may have considered out of character for a president to do back in 2016. But yeah, thinking about, like, the revolving door of people within all of the executive branch's agencies and the people who've been, you know, stripped of security clearance because they pushed back on a particular measure that was proposed, or that, you know, hey, I don't like it when you discredit the entire, you know, national intelligence agencies, and they're like, it's like, okay, well, goodbye.
And the revolving door of people coming in and out of the administration, how many, I cannot recall so many changes in chiefs of staff or press secretaries, or it's interesting why that bar has been set so low.
I think we've been sort of run down, you know, and You know, you have to save your capacity for outrage for something worthwhile, you know? But I mean, like you're saying, it's definitely some of the more, I guess in the grand scheme of things, minute, bizarre things are really unprecedented, unlike, you know, trying to censor people or creating an enemies list and intending to use the power of the president to shut them down.
And it's, I think it's just even considering Adams, who was the second president, did this, I wonder, is it something about the job itself that is creates, you know, like is a breeding ground for ego tripping or abuse of power, or, you know, in a more technical term, or, you know, some sort of, like, what is it that's creating that led Adams, Trump, and Nixon to going the, let's say, the extra mile in invading citizens and just people's constitutional rights, as opposed to, like, other presidents that did it, I guess, in a less obvious way. Because Nixon at least kept it secret until he, you know, it was brought out to the public. So if it wasn't brought up to the public, what would they have done with that list? You know, what these are, and this is what, again, and even back to Adams, you know, in the 700s, it was only because of, you know, of like conflict with friends in the States that, like, they were negotiating. They were, France had stolen some, or hijacked some ships in America. John Adams was saying, hey, you know, I'll give you some money, you bring them back, I don't want to have a war. And those negotiations came, were made public. So it's another thing where something that is done in secret is made public, there's outrage, and then instead of fixing the situation or even just facing it heads on, you are blaming and punishing the people that are simply doing their jobs, whether it's journalists or just, you know, anything, whether it's journalists or lawyers or committees that are meant and created to find fraud and abuse of power. So,
yeah,
you know.
Well, one thing that comes to mind for me, at least in terms of John Adams, is, like, who did he come after, right? Like, George Washington did the American Revolution. Everybody loved him. His whole precedent of doing two terms, everyone's like, no, 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 stay, do more terms, be our king, basically. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. Trust me, it'll be better. And then that, like, trend wasn't broken until FDR. So imagine having to fill those shoes of someone that was, you know, largely mm-hmm. beloved. And then now it's like, oh, this is your replacement? Woof. It's like, hey, alien decision, you're going to jail. Don't say mean things about me. But I mean, I think we have, as the, like, the reputation of the U.S. and, like, our influence has grown, I think it's become, like, a part of the office that, you know, the president is supposed to sort of be magnanimous and, like, you know, take, if someone kind of hits you with a dig, whether that's a foreign leader or someone in your own party, or you attend a dinner party and it goes bad, like, you kind of have to take it in stride. At least with Nixon, I will say the consternation, the anger was internal, which doesn't mm-hmm. like excuse it, but, you know, at the very least it wasn't airing everyone's dirty laundry, accusing your critic of murder like 15 years ago. What's that about? I mean, look, they fall under the same category, but I think it's important now.
You're referring to the tweets?
Yeah, referring to the tweets. I think it's important now and again to get grounded in, hey, whoa, I don't know about that. Like, you shouldn't. That's libel, and it doesn't, libel law doesn't apply to the social media, but I mean, I think it goes back to what you were saying, is that trying to put regulations on the truth when it comes to social media, if that's indeed what he wants to do, you're going to be hard pressed to find a lawyer who's given that and won't, you know, look at you as well.
And so now, I mean, that's just nuts that it went from, you know, quote unquote, the media being the enemy of the people, to now Twitter is the enemy of the people? The internet is? That's interesting. Okay, we're just, you know, that's quite broad, but at least I don't know. It doesn't seem like a very reasonable thing. And then is Twitter going to be our saving grace? Are they going to be the thing that's going to tell people, hey, you might want to fact check this? And a follow-up question to that, why haven't they been doing it up to now? Like, this is where their boundaries, like, this is what crossed the lines. Like, I don't think this is the first time that something false or divisive or, again, just false was tweeted. So what line is crossed this time? And so if anyone is listening out there and would like to give us your two cents, you can call in at 503-231-8187. You're listening to The Gap. I'm Cammie, and on the line with me is the lovely Althea Billing.
Hello. hi. I'm still here.
You're still here. We're talking about Adams, Trump, and Nixon. What do they all have in common? Fake news.
They have a hard time keeping a lid on how they feel about people. One thing that I think is interesting about the Trump and Twitter is that, right, tech companies did come under a lot of scrutiny, Twitter included, with when all the Cambridge Analytica and 2016 mm-hmm. election meddling stuff came out. And I think more obvious is Zuckerberg's kind of attitude towards it, which is like, meh, you know, like, meh, I don't know. Do we care? Is that my job? I don't feel like it's my job. Whereas in the early primary season, Twitter's reaction was, hey, we're not going to take any political ads because of their potential to spread misinformation. And according to them, this tweet basically saying that mail-in voting is going to be fraudulent, which, right, we didn't talk about that specifically, not a good thing to say, because it does sort of like set the table for this idea that because of coronavirus, we really might have to introduce mail-in voting in mm-hmm. a much quicker process than it came to be in Oregon or Washington, for example. It's going to have to be rolled out quick if we're going to get this election off the ground. And so there is concern, and there has been concern from Democrats and conservatives, that it's table setting for delaying the election or calling the results of the election, if they turn out not to be in his favor, fraudulent.
Is a fraud, yeah.
That was not a good election. And so I think Twitter, unlike Facebook, after the whole 2016 thing, they took some of that to heart. It's an interesting time to make a stand about it, but, you know, it should be something that theoretically is uncontroversial. It's like, look at the numbers. Do the numbers support that, you know, of the states that have mail-in voting, that they have widespread voter fraud, that, you know, people are hulking out and ripping into the mailboxes to shred them or copy them? Like, it's something that has been tested. You know, it's not like this, you know, we're not rolling out ranked choice voting or voting on the internet. You know, that would be something to be really
worried about. Ooh,
don't
tell Zuckerberg that.
Yeah, no. I mean, we saw how that went in the Iowa primaries, trying to report on your phone. It went badly, in case anybody forgot. But yeah, I don't. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
We've got
a.
What? You said there's a caller, Sonia?
There is. It's our old pal, Edie, and she's going to tell you where you. She's got a correction for us. Go ahead, Edie. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Hey, Edie, thank you.
I'm really grateful you're having this topic and you're saying it so factfully. Just wanted to correct one thing. George Washington was not loved and wanted. His troops hated him. He was brutal and insane, irrational, selfish, and thieving. And a lot of this is just to increase his own wealth and to avoid the United Kingdom, Great Britain, stopping them from having the slave industry that he was dependent upon. And if he had to stay under Great Britain's rule and give up his slaves and the land that he was stealing from Indians through faults, you know, just being a land surveyor and everything, he was the wealthiest individual in the Western Hemisphere. And, everybody that knew him practically hated him, and he could make far more money and have far more power by leaving the presidency. And he just was a real manipulator of the press and the propaganda and the lies. And he also assassinated, or had people assassinated, who would be speaking the truth about him.
All right. Well, I will have to do some more reading on Washington. That's a American education system in my brain.
Hated him.
Thank you bring for up your contribution. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So it makes you wonder, I guess, is this office just one that breeds this type of behavior, whether it's done in silence, whether it's done just out there, in the open? And like you said, it's up to the truth tellers to tell the truth. But if their job is truth tellers, they tell the truth and they get, punished for it. Well, then that's not a job. That's basically a martyr, you know?
Well, and it's interesting to think about it in terms of George Washington and John Adams, because at that point, the power of the president was way more limited than it is now. Congress was really, where things got done. Congress was empowered to do a lot more stuff that now, the executive has the majority of control over, the control of, the national narrative, priorities. Executive orders weren't really a thing that you could use to be powerful back in the day. All of that kind of stuff got expanded since then. So it's interesting to think about it in those terms, too.
Imagine if some of our past presidents had Twitter and what type of stuff they would be posting on there.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that, history... Sometimes you paint things with a rose-colored brush. That doesn't mean anything. But it gets a little hazy, we forget about the weird parts. But that,
histories, yeah. I mean, things get whitewashed, they get pinkwashed, all of that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they also, this isn't the term that I'm going to coin, but they get weirdwashed. Things have been weird for forever, and I think that there's a sense of we used to be better than this, way back in our agrarian roots, we were, common sense folk or something like that, but we've been weird the whole time. I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, a bunch of Warren G. Harding's love letters resurfaced, and that's kind of a fun thing to introduce, not a president that most of your civics class is focused on, Warren G. Harding. But
he's not the flashy kind.
He's not a flashy man. Those letters, though, they were flashy. Look it up. Not going to discuss it here, but yeah.
Interesting. Well,
yeah.
And all these things can resurface, if they do resurface, and then it's I guess it's the same thing where now we're looking at history with what we know now, so it's that's I guess our perception is always going to be a little bit skewed one way or another, because of it's also a matter of where you are in history, where you are socioeconomics, all of that stuff plays in. But I think that one thing that makes it, accessibility, right? And the internet is it grants accessibility to it. It's accessible to a majority of people. There are people who don't have the internet, sure. But the people who do have it can sign up to a website like Twitter or Facebook for free and create an account and basically, do as they please within some stipulations and limitations. But also they're free to, follow whoever they want. Now, when you have instances for example, not a president, I'll say Elon Musk. Remember a while ago, he tweeted something that caused the Tesla stocks
Tulsa,
to go down.
Tulsa, Oklahoma? The city of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
He's just taking everything now. But the stocks went down, and then he also went on, you know, the Seth Rogen or the Joe, and was smoking cannabis, which caused stocks to go down as well. But all of these things, you know, some people were saying that this is kind of a premeditated chain of events that happened because he wanted the stocks to go down. So it's almost, you know, and that's kind of, if you're posting false facts that eventually will give you the benefit of the doubt, then aren't you, is that manipulating? It's just straight up manipulation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting how there's more slippery terms that I think get kind of twisted. It's like, oh, he was being ironic. Oh, that was sarcasm. You guys can't take a joke. It was sarcasm. He was sarcastically telling people to inject themselves with disinfectants. Or not telling people, telling doctors, can we look into that? Which isn't, like, better. I just want to say that. Just speaking of Trump, I think that was that last week? I don't know. The days blur together.
I just don't understand. I just don't understand, like, where... Why are the reporters being held accountable for speaking the truth? You know, why is Twitter now, why is there even a conversation about the internet being shut down as opposed to, hey, folks, stop posting fake things to people that look up to you and, you know, can eventually have, like, serious repercussion on, the, oh, I don't know, democracy, the American, like, way of life and stuff? And
well,
it's really important.
Yeah, well, and, you know, of the reactions to that executive order that Trump issued yesterday, one of them was from this guy from, like, a tech policy think tank, and I remember his quote very distinctly. He said, this is not how the Constitution works. The Constitution protects Twitter from Trump. It doesn't protect Trump from Twitter, which is an important distinction when we think about, like, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. That stuff applies to you differently when you are the face of the government, you know, like, you don't get to sort of decry that a free speech as a value versus free speech as a legal principle are a little bit different. So it's, you know, you're on the other side of the line now, you know, you don't get to say that you've been treated unfairly when you are, when you have that much power.
So Gab,
that's
crew.
Interestingly.
We have a guest on the line. I believe Tim is waiting. Tim, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, Tim. You're on the air.
Okay. I just got a question. I'm no big fan of George Washington. I know he was a slave owner and he had faults, but this is the first I ever heard that he was the richest dude in the Western Hemisphere, which I doubt, because that would include Spanish colonies as well. And then, also, this is the first time I ever heard anything about him assassinating his rivals or critics, and first time I ever heard that he was kind of like universally hated. If he was hated so much, how did he become president? But anyways, I was just wondering what was the basis for those accusations. If they're true, then we should hold it. It should be exposed. But I don't see a point in exaggerating if that's the case. So I want to know, where did she come up with this stuff?
Yeah, point well taken, Tim. You know, what I know of Washington is definitely like a, sounds like a similar narrative to what you've heard before. So I would be interested as well as, you know, looking into that more. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think that all of that stuff that I've heard would be untrue, and not to say that, like, you know, certain aspects of history don't get papered over. Like, George Washington didn't have wooden teeth. He had teeth that were like his dentures or whatever were made of like sheep's teeth and slaves' teeth. So that's a little bit not something that you tell like a 6-year-old when they're starting to learn about government. I don't know who's going to come in here and defend George Washington. I'm not really sure, but yeah, the things that I tend to remember is that he was a slaveholder, but that some of that had to do with sort of kicking that conversation down the road, which, you know, found the country, great. Could we have the conversation? Maybe we should have. And also that he was, people wanted him to stay in power. Those are some of the things that I recall. Tammy, do you have any kind of knowledge about that kind of stuff?
That's pretty much it. Although the second that you, I realized someone held slaves, they're kind of the bad guy in my book, point period. Like, there's no room for discussion, saying, well, the times, nope, don't care, nope, bad guy. I'm not sure where I think Edie got the information, although, darn, I wish that I could connect y'all together to, because that would probably be a very interesting conversation to listen to.
Yeah. Let's have a robust discussion about who was George Washington. I am very confident that there's a lot of good literature out there for folks who are interested. Unfortunately, on our, you know, short little show in the morning, we do not have that definitive fact for you, but
I say George Washington Unplugged.
That's what we're doing next week. Tune in next week, where we've spent an entire week deep in his biographies, picking him apart. This is where it all began.
Yes, all the acoustic version. But thank you, Tim. We do appreciate, you know, just hearing from you. And thank you for calling in. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is The Gap. I'm Tammy. On the line with me is the lovely and jubilant Althea Billing.
Jubilant. Nice.
We are talking about we're talking about hashtag fake news, Trump, Nixon, and Adams. I was going to say, what do they have in common, hashtag fake news? Or I guess they really, really hate fake news / news.
I wish the news was fake. I know that joke's been made, but damn.
what do you mean by that?
Oh, I wish that what was happening wasn't true.
Oh yeah, like all of this was just a dream, and we'll wake up and
like a fun prank, you know? Like, oh, you thought we were gonna censor social media so that you can't say stuff on there anymore. You thought we were gonna do that. We're not actually. We got it wrong. We just tricked you.
He was being sarcastic.
Actually, fine. That's sarcasm. Yeah, thank you.
What's not sarcastic is that Mitch really Mitch is trying to join in. Mitch, are you still with us? Go ahead, Mitch, you're on the air.
This conversation, you know, it should jump back and forth between history, which we don't get enough of, and news coverage, because news is without context, and what's going on now. So history needs to inform what's going on now, but so much gets pushed out with the Trump sideshow that we don't really get to look around the world or look around our own world. And right now in Israel, they have the head of state that's on trial for criminal charges. I mean, we're not talking impeachment. We're talking taking money and making deals with the heads of newspapers to influence how Netanyahu is being covered in Israel. And this is an actual criminal trial that if you go to the Hebrew press or the English press in Israel, you will find incredible stuff that is an absolute reflection of what we don't deal with in the Western countries like the U.S. or England or France, where we don't put our heads of state on criminal trial. And that's what leads to people like Trump having this misinformed idea, or Nixon did, that they're above criminal prosecution. Well, you know, not only is Netanyahu now on trial and it's all public and out in the open, but being suppressed in the Western press, usually by my own community, the Jewish community, because we don't want, to stoke a new anti-Semitic wave. Oh, those Jews, you know, you can't even trust them in their own country, that kind of thing. But it really doesn't help matters, because Netanyahu's predecessor, Ehud Olmert, as prime minister, was also found guilty and charged and actually sent to prison. And these are examples. These are very important examples for us in the West, as was the South Korean president, who a couple of years ago was put on criminal trial, and all we heard about was North Korea, which is a joke of a country, when in fact South Korea, which is an economic dynamo, put their head of state on trial, sent her to prison for 26 years, and also criminally convicted the corporate elites who were bribing her. So we don't discuss this in our media, and what's going on with Bibi in Israel now is something that should be covered, because he's such a close, Trump stole a lot of his playbook from Bibi, not that Bibi innovated anything, he's just a crook, but, you know, that it's pretty interesting that this stuff is not deemed newsworthy in this country.
I have to agree with you 110% about the similarities between the way that the current administration in the States is handling things, as well as the Likud Bibi's people in Israel. The whole, there is a coronavirus pandemic, so we're going to institute an emergency government. It basically means I'm never leaving. I'm going to be prime minister until the day I die, which, you know, that's what I get from that. That I can definitely see Trump's, you know, like his tweets about how mail-in votes cause frauds and stuff like that. That those are the stepping stones to saying, I'm not going to leave office in November. Now, that's just my hypothesis. I could be completely wrong. But there are a lot of so many similarities between the two. And I appreciate you bringing that up. That's something that definitely doesn't get enough coverage. And I think that they're now going to be doing like their third election. So we'll see where that goes.
The trial is more interesting than the elections, because what the trial is bringing out is that Bibi was entering into private financial deals with the head of one of Israel's better newspapers, Yediot Ahronot, and that the publisher of that newspaper, which has been very critical of Bibi throughout history, actually came around to cutting a deal with Bibi for more favorable coverage. And this is exactly what you were talking about with your previous callers on the phone, about how people like Washington's public personae were shaped by media. And we should be talking about this. I think this is not something that should be pushed to the side by the Trump sideshow.
Definitely. I really thank you for that point. Althea, you have anything to add?
Yeah, what comes to mind for me is the idea that, you know, we don't put our presidents on, like, criminal trial, right? And that there's not, like, a necessarily, like, it's constitutionally, it's sort of like a question, could the president get convicted of anything while in office? And, you know, we have X number of years of history of kind of this sort of, like, what's the word? I'm like courtesy, I suppose. Mm. Of even if you got impeached, like, hey, we're not. You're the president. We're not going to go like take all. We're not going to go rifle through all your stuff. You know, like we're going to be cool about it. And you know, if you did something bad, you'll have to reckon with it once you're out of office. And I don't know that that's necessarily the right way of doing things, but I think that you can see how that sort of attitude of like, oh, like, you know, stay back, that's the president, we don't take investigating the president lightly, which maybe in most cases like a good attitude, is kind of twisted and corrupted when it comes to Trump, because that is not just something that sort of offers the president, that's something that he has, you know, grabbed onto with gusto, and that you can't touch me, who else have you ever done this to, you can't do it to me. But I also don't want to say that sort of practice is necessarily a good thing. That idea of civility, you know, take the Iran-Contra affair, for example. You know, Reagan, this is from what I've understood about it, Reagan knew. And it's frustrating that he didn't have to have any kind of reckoning for that. Mm-hmm. Whole situation, which was very twisted and, you know, sad, and why are you doing that? because of that kind of courtesy, and not, you know, you're not going to grill the president. You're not going to ask the president a question that you don't want, that he doesn't want to answer. And I mean, I think that kind of goes back to the Mueller report of, like, when that investigation was happening, the president was like, okay, you can, like, send me questions and I'll send them back to you, or, like, I'll talk to you, but, like, you know, I get to decide what we talk about, which isn't an investigation. And so, you know, when we think about those privileges of the executive, it's important to think about what is important about keeping them. Like, what does that prevent, right? Like, we want to prevent, you know, the president from being bogged down in kind of, like, daily dealings that don't actually matter, or someone kind of coming after them for no reason. Insert here birther conspiracy. Like, it would have been great to not have to deal with that. That took up a bunch of President Obama's time. But then you also have to think about the flip side of it, where, you know, the truth is obscured and people aren't held accountable. And so maybe there's a way to kind of evolve that mentality. And I do wonder what will happen in terms of thinking about that when Trump is out of office.
Also, I would say that what fills the vacuum of hard news is exactly the kind of Alex Jones, you know, fantasy stuff that fills the gap. Because when you look at how Hillary Clinton was covered from the time that Obama anointed her Secretary of State, and one of the first things she did was assist in the Honduran military overthrow of their democratically elected government. And she got virtually, that was off limits for mainstream American news coverage. If it were not for Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, she would not have faced one hard question about her role in the Honduran military overthrow that led to Honduran kids winding up on our border without their parents because of what a state of chaos Honduras had descended into, and again, because Washington has traditionally used that country as their gateway to Central America and for all sorts of gun running and arm smuggling to fund stuff that the taxpayers won't fund. So, you know, this stuff, what fills the gap with lunacy in our news coverage is the absence of hard coverage on things that are taboo. They're taboo because the business people say they're taboo. They're certainly in the public interest to cover what Hillary did as Secretary of State, or what her son-in-law was doing at running a hedge fund that at the same time she was Secretary of State was trying to make tons of money on the lack of a bailout of Greece by the EU. I mean, how is that not a conflict of interest when her son-in-law is making money off stuff that's in her purview in her professional life? It's just unbelievable. And so what happened was, what filled that vacuum was all this stuff about Hillary being somehow tied to a murder ring at a pizzeria in Washington, D.C. That fills the vacuum.
I remember that. I was living in D.C. during that time. It was everywhere. It is up to the media. It is up to.
I think it should be up to media consumers to demand better.
That's another thing that I. At the end of the day, you know, if people choose to watch a news source that is, you know, fills the gap with things like, say, like Alex Jones, or things that are more, you know, like conspiracies about Pizzagate and all that stuff. If that's what they choose to feed themselves, then that's what they're going to know. But that doesn't, you know, negate the, like, the hard work that journalists are doing, like you said, like Amy Goodman, or, you know, even the news department at KABU, and you know, all sorts of different outlets that are doing, and also like the grassroots organizations that come from these instances. And so things are being done, but I also want to know, like, why these type of things get so much traction. Like, why, how is, well, I guess because it's more interesting to think that there is a conspiracy theory at a pizza shop than actual crimes being committed by people in the highest office in the land, which I can't really explain that one.
Yeah, it's more interesting to think that it's all connected as opposed to, like, chaotic and random and sometimes terrible. Why isn't everybody working together in some sort of mysterious cabal in a pizza joint, you know?
The engineer has a thought on that.
Oh, please.
Well, to carefully examine the machinations of those who manage the system would require a careful examination of the operation of the system and how and why and in what way it makes it possible for the managers to use it in that way, mainly, you know, to use the power of the system to enrich themselves personally at the expense of the masses, which would lead to a questioning of the entire ball game, as it were, and it would bring down the entire system. So it's really about the major parties will let each other get away with all kinds of shenanigans in order to protect. There's this like this mutual protection. They will protect each other from us.
Cartel dynamics, exactly true.
And that goes back to Nixon, you know, when he had this opponents list and enemies list, there were a lot of different mechanisms in individuals, bodies, government bodies that were working to actually, you know, intimidate people that were on this list, to discredit them in the public eye. So it's, yeah, you're right, it is a keeping of the status quo. And unfortunately, it comes with a lot of force and violence, you know, with it.
And it's business as usual. And I think what helps keep business as usual from being analyzed, not only is that it takes a little more focus and concentration, and it's drier than the Pizzagate stuff, but one of the things that helps the cartel dynamics is that, and I'm sorry to use this term, I don't mean to be, you know, misunderstood here, but the people who play the label game and the identity game, it's as if, like with all my coworkers, it's about, are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? Are you a liberal? Mm-hmm. Are you a conservative? Are you pro-life? Are you, you know, anti-life? Are you a hawk? Are you a dove? But these labels mean nothing because there isn't an ideology that's worth a damn. They all wither in the face of personal opportunistic business deals. And that's a lot drier to cover, but you know, there's the Democratic establishment, like your engineer was just trying to say, had a lot to do with the ascension of the Republican right by what they chose not to pursue or enforce, like antitrust. I mean, everyone wants to look the other way in antitrust. And yet, here we have a movement in which corporations have bled this country dry. But there's no antitrust enforcement. And when you get people like Shoshana Zuboff, who's such a pioneer coming out of Harvard, the bastion of the golden passport, and for 20 years her work on monopolies and the age of surveillance capitalism, she couldn't get into the golden Rolodex of news experts. And Larry Summers, who was advising every president from Reagan through Obama, and now he's got hired by Biden to be his chief economic advisor. When Larry Summers was the head of Harvard, he was disparaging women for their lack of intellectual contributions, and people like Zuboff were in the business school. They couldn't, you know, get anything in their work amplified or repeated because it would have put Google's entire business model in question. So, I mean, you know, there's so much complicity to go around.
Is it complicity or is it just, you know, not going against it because of your personal interest? You know, it's just,
well,
at
look,
a certain point, personal interests become, they outweigh the truth, you know?
Look, me and my coworkers who work for minimum wage, we don't have access to a lot of information. But when the professional class in America, many of whom consider themselves in labeling and in identity politics to be liberal, can keep quiet about the really nasty stuff, like Hillary's role in Honduras, or the role of Goldman Sachs in her son-in-law's Eaglevale partner hedge fund. When this stuff can be kept out of the media so that, you know, the Pizzagates can flood the vacuum in the media and say, oh, look how ridiculous it is, you know. By dismissing that kind of media, we're really hurting ourselves, because the real muckrakers aren't, you know, getting... The real muckrakers is what would try and keep our institutional corruption at below the level of critical mass. I think Trump is the example of it exceeding critical mass. I thought Obama was more dangerous than Trump because he did so much nasty stuff, but he was so elegant and businesslike about it. Nobody thought that instituting a drone assassination program, they just thought he was being a lot more effective than invading Iraq, which is what his predecessor did.
Well, I'm going to have to cut you off right there, only because we are running out of time. I would really appreciate all your cerebral input, and that's why we chose to go kind of like in the history route, because all of this stuff isn't necessarily new. It has been and has been. We really appreciate you calling in, and I guess we have about a minute left. Althea, would you like the final say?
I just want to thank everybody for listening, tuning into The Gap. It's been good conversation today, and always fun to remember history, I suppose.
Remember history. If you don't, history will have you.
There you go.
That makes sense? Yeah, there you go. Thank you all so much. Have a good rest of the day.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon. 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your